All right, this is going to be part two of our interview with Mark LeClaire, and we're going to jump back on to a point that Terrence McKenna made about psychedelic use and whether or not it was dangerous. McKenna had said that he felt they were dangerous, but only if one took too little. So, Mark, you wanted to relate this to something Alan Watts said?
Yeah, during the break, I had an added thought about that. I basically think that McKenna's statement is true, but it's like it's the beginning of a bridge, and I want to just try and kind of fill out the rest of that. Very briefly, the true psychedelic experience, and it has been described as breaking open the head, basically. This does require what I'm going to say this honestly, it will require a courageous use of hallucinogenic drugs. It will require some courage on your part because it is breaking open the head. And that, I wanted to offer just kind of a caveat. I hate to be a Cassandra, but and then just to add to that, finally, what Alan Watts said about the use of psychedelics. This is not Alan Watt, the conspiracy theorist. This is Alan Watts. And he was actually a precursor of Timothy Leary. He knew Leary. And they were both California dudes, and Alan Watts kind of was right there at the beginning of that cultural movement, and friends with Jack Kerouac also. And what Alan Watts said about psychedelics was, when you get the message, hang up the phone. And I think that that's true. You don't need to break open your head every day just to prove you can do it. You do need to get through the experience, and it's a kind of a dark night of the soul. It can be, because you're going to be confronting, ultimately, a massive truth that's very hard to explain, and it can be my most profound psychedelic experience was not strictly positive. It was only positive in retrospect. As a matter of fact, in the moment, it was utterly horrifying. Basically, now I'm a pretty hung up guy. I'm not relaxed, and I don't hang around a lot of other people. So for me, it might have been a little worse than it might be for other people. If you're with some friends you can really trust and things like that, and you're willing, you know, a la Bill Hicks or whatever, you know, and you're going to push yourself over the edge Bill Hicks style. I think that's the ultimate way to do it with a few people you really trust, not so much alone and in a kind of a psychic isolation like I did it, basically. But the ultimate confrontation is can be quite striking. But once it's had, I honestly don't think it needs to be repeated to prove itself. It can be done again, but the message is going to be the same. If you actually get the message, you'll know. And you're going to be living in that world forever after. I have experiences, regular experiences, where I feel like I am heavily dosed on mushrooms. And sometimes it lasts for many hours or a whole day, and I'll collapse in exhaustion, basically. And I have to try and act normal during all of this because I'm not actually on mushrooms. And yet you are, because it is, in a sense, it's a seed that doesn't really leave your body once you've achieved the levels. So I've ranted on enough about that. Yeah, I did want to say that, you know, when you get the message, you can hang up the phone.
Okay. I agree with everything said right there.
Even Ray Manzarek hung up the phone eventually. He just really loved the conversation. And he turned to meditation, by the way.
Yeah.
He and the other members of the Doors turned to meditation. They all gave up LSD and alcohol and turned to meditation, and that is the correct answer. I think. But anyway, go on.
It's at the center of it all for me. It still is. True. It's still at the center of it all because it's offered to you. It's all right there. But it's...
Yes, it's true. It's true.
And it's just so misunderstood. And there's so much disinformation about it, and it just it's sort of like the word love. Everyone carries it with them and uses it and has their own definition and experience of it. But if everyone did have it, why the fuck does everyone hate so many people? So
yes, it's true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I guess, well, we'll just let this flow for however it does. I'll say this. Okay, breaking open the head. My understanding of what I like the way you put it, the true psychedelic experience offers. for me, you know, the image of the Vesica Piscis, right? Mm. And we'll just follow this model, and I think it'll make sense. If we are going to, we've read about this and we seem to understand it. We have an unconscious mind and we have a conscious mind, right?
Yes.
We have an experience of being awake.
We only know that thanks to those two people like Sigmund Freud who managed to figure that out.
Okay. They put it into a new language for our Western linear minds to understand.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay.
I do have a bit of hero worship for Sigmund Freud, so one of my major flaws. Anyway, let's continue.
If we also want to extend that model into right brain, left brain, mm-hmm. if we want to say that that is legitimate, well, for me, a psychedelic fuses those two completely. They eclipse each other. And in that eclipse, what you bring into it with your linear mind, the programming that you've gotten, fuses into an eternal manifestation with that right brain or that creative brain.
I agree. Yes. It is a binder, if you will.
It's a binder. Yeah. And it's an eclipse. And that's why that image in 2001 is so powerful, is that
That movie somehow became famous for Kubrick. Not to get down to Kubrick, although I would love to, but his genius, his timing of that film, everything. Oh. And again, you know how I feel about Kubrick. My feelings about Kubrick are the intelligence. Certainly of the 20th century, possibly the greatest single mind. And his timing of releasing that film. You know, the fact that it was a psychedelic experience, he was capitalizing on the age in so many ways, basically trying to push this idea through. This is why just for people out there who don't understand Kubrick, this is why his movies aren't understood. He was making movies appreciated 150, 200 years after they were made, basically.
There was a comment in a thread on a website. John Phil Ryan had posted 11 things you might have missed in The Shining.
Yes.
And, you know, very specific and very sort of minutia. Like, John has deconstructed that movie in such a brilliant way.
Oh, absolutely.
And these were just, I'm not saying they were throwaway things, but they were not necessarily the meat and potatoes of breaking down a film like The Shining. But,
right.
You know, he just was putting it out there. A lot of the comments were, you know, the typical, you've got too much time on your hands, blah, blah, blah.
Isn't that hilarious?
They're just continuity errors. But then someone said something that I think struck at the heart of the matter, and it spoke so many volumes. He said, everyone knows that film directors back then, they made films that were designed only to be seen once. That continuity errors would not enter into the awareness of the viewer because they were going to the movie theater, they would see it once, and that was all they would ever see from it. And I was like, that is exactly the conscious understanding of what one would, and I don't claim to speak for them, but an atheist, what their worldview would be. This life is just something that you live once, and then when it's over, crumple it up, and it's gone. It's gone.
Lovely.
Forever. And yeah. I'm like, when you get into the psychedelic experience, the true psychedelic experience, there's enough people who agree on this point that you walk into the eternal recurrence of your moment, and you see into your past, and you see into your future, and it's this eclipse. It's all happening to you right now. Everything that you've read in history still has an effect on your reality right now.
Christ
wasn't killed 2,000 years ago. He was killed right now.
Yeah. Every time you sit down to have your lunch.
So that is the eclipse.
I heard about it on TV.
Who says you're boring, man? Man, so that person's trying to think that Stanley Kubrick spent how many years in pre-production, how many years, how many takes, with the awareness that they're only going to see this once, the popcorn and nacho buying public, and I need to, and I'm making a scary movie for people who are going to see this once, and I better do it right the first time, or else they'll think, bad movie, Stanley. That is just, and that is sort of just an echo of how people might view creation and reality and what this
absolutely
is.
Yeah.
And it's just, and so
I'm just going to say that maybe it's subconscious. I wouldn't call it unconscious on your part, but you are comparing the creator to Stanley Kubrick at this point.
Well, you know, the strike, where's the lightning, right? But that is the essence. So I think that having had the true psychedelic experience, it was such a profound and deeply rewarding moment when I turned on to Stanley Kubrick. And when I went, I had come to a point where I had seemingly exhausted all those people on the fringe who had recorded their sort of breast beating into the night and trying to leave their document for those that would follow them. And then when I gazed upon Stanley Kubrick with this lens and with some helpful hints and clues from other writers like yourself, and, you know, Rob Adger has to be there because his work is
absolutely
valuable.
Absolutely brilliant. Bernstein. His work is brilliant. The man is a complete nitwit. but no, it's true. Like I've said about Adger, just, you know, to make the point, every Kubrick researcher should read his work.
Oh, yes, completely.
Because he's the entry-level guy. That's what I would say. You should start with Rob Adger because he will open up your eyes to the complexity and to the possibility in Kubrick films. Unfortunately for Adger, his conclusions are very tepid, basically. He is a Stanley Kubrick fan, basically. And he doesn't want to offend any concept of Kubrick other than that of some kind of I remember I got into an argument with Adrian. He said, "Are you kidding me? Kubrick is not a monster. He's a chess player and a filmmaker." And I thought, okay. He might not be a monster. And I didn't call him a monster, by the way. He just inferred that from my writing. His forum. And he was very angry with me. He took down his whole forum because of that. Because of that conversation. Thousands of posts. And I knew. I was an arrow to his heart. He got the message. And I used his own information. You know, I said to him, "Do you really think that a guy, a filmmaker of Stanley Kubrick's intelligence, his extraordinary, legendary, and obvious attention to detail, would put in Vietnamese on a water tower, the words, 'to continuously serve your majesty, Satan,' and it's some kind of oblique comment on how war is hell? I mean, wake up, it's a signature, buddy." And he just, you know, he cracked at that point. But you're right, Adger, brilliant.
So it's a comfort and it's a distraction and it's everything that's great about art. And unfortunately, and as anyone learns, there's nothing that you can, well, maybe this is sort of the struggle of the writer today and sort of our
position. I'm just
getting up
to grab a drink here.
Go for it.
You keep talking.
Is that in a comment section where I have left a few notes, you're not going to convince somebody who is thinking that a Kubrick movie was meant for the movie theater and for the popcorn-buying public to be seen once. You're just not going to convince them. So you don't waste your time. There's no point getting into an argument. It's not really to even be upset about it.
No, of course not. No.
It just sort of paints the picture. And I would say in that comment section to that article, which is on thequietus.com, Q-U-I-E-T-U-S, that I would say 50% of the comments are more of the, You're wasting your time. They're continuity errors. And then the other half are a certain measure of fascination and a certain measure of that's good work. I hadn't seen that before. Mm-hmm. So I think that what this kind of ties into is, I guess this is sort of the direction maybe I want to take this now, is that I was saying the idea of reality testing. One can have the most brilliant and lucid and completely constructed insight in your head, but it's the bringing down into the world of other people that is the true test. Mm. Sometimes those flashes of vision are so sublime and so... they're just... you feel like to mention them would to destroy them. That you feel like, or to even mention it would be the ultimate mark of a fool. That it would, that there's no point. You're just wasting someone's time. I'm just late to the party on this. The thought or the vision is so transcendent that you just let it go. And I think that's some part of the Niagara of thought in a psychedelic experience. You don't write it down because it's all around you. Or it's embedded.
When you start to, you start. And this is the funny thing, is that if you've had a true experience of this kind, however it is achieved, and it's going to be different, obviously, for every person, because the beauty of this is it's related to you. As you said, it's about your own mind coming together, right?
Yes.
And it's about how suddenly so many things you thought insignificant, meaningless, pointless, in every detail, just some kind of leaf passing in the wind can become filled with, well, not can be, but does become filled with meaning. So that's what's happening. You know, it's your mind coming together. I can't remember exactly what you were saying, but...
I'm going back to reality testing, and I think that what my favorite, well, the launching point for Kubrick for me is the chess scene in 2001. So Hal goes through a reality testing experiment with Frank Poole when he cheats at chess.
And he tells Frank that he's going to lose when, in fact, he's got a winning position.
Yeah.
Psychological testing, for sure.
Psychological testing.
And that comes up later when David says, you're doing your crew's psychology profile, aren't you? So, yes, that's what he's doing. He's testing the limits of Frank's gullibility, almost. And, of course, we can all see how Frank ends up. So.
And whether or not Frank's eyes are even open. Hal sees that his eyes are open, but clearly... they might as well be literally shut, because the board is right in front of him and someone is saying something to him, his eyes close, and he just listens.
Yes.
Who is more of a robot in that scene? So when Kubrick does this to the movie-going audience, half of the people have no idea the complexities of chess, so they're not even robots. They're not even turned on. There are other people who might think that they are chess masters who see that, but they leave the theater and it never occurred to them that, wait a second, what happened there? That wasn't what was. It was right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And it's the beginning of the conversation of Hal and what Hal is in that movie. And it's the beginning of the conversation of what Kubrick is as a director, because Kubrick is spelling it all out. For those with eyes open enough to see, with brains that are free to think and to think through the movie, they can understand what he's trying to communicate.
Sure, but I would certainly not say that anyone other than some kind of, well, someone like you or I now could get a complete grasp of that film on the first viewing. That I mean, it would take some time, I would think.
But I think they're out there. But I think they're out there. A person with the kind of...
well, you know, they are out there because you are now.
Okay.
But you probably weren't when you first saw 2001.
Well, no, not even close.
That's the whole point.
Exactly.
That movie is an eye-opening experience. If you and this goes only slightly, just to contradict the concept of seeing a Kubrick film once. I mean, this man is a seductive genius, and he doesn't squander any opportunity. He knows that many people will never come back to his films, and he's more than willing to fuck with their heads, too. Even he doesn't care whether they think he's a boring idiot or not. And that includes movie critics. Oh, my, how he must have laughed at the movie critics. Oh, my God. Can you imagine the laughs he got out of that?
It could keep you entertained for decades, man.
Going back and reading reviews, old reviews of Kubrick films when they came out, it's astonishing.
You know what it is? It's the whole Mark Twain thing. It's being able to be at your own funeral. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's the Finnegan's Wake thing as well.
Absolutely.
Just on the Finnegan's Wake touch, because I know you're a huge Joyce fan. Quite frankly, I'm a little bit in awe of you in that respect, because Joyce is such an intimidating writer, basically. But, the Harford's apartment is 5A, right?
Okay.
Well, that's 5. 5 is Finn, right? It's Finn again. That's the name of their apartment. And, of course, Kubrick himself is sitting out there on the bench watching a movie the whole time, right?
Wow. That's good.
Yeah. See, I know that you think of The Shining as Finnegan's Wake, but I think you're wrong. Finnegan's Wake is actually, or The Shining is actually The Dead.
Okay, I can be persuaded.
Just take another look at The Dead, and it, believe me, the principles. Well, I mean, obviously, the thing of it is, it's all in there with Kubrick. It's all in there. So you can't really get away from. He was definitely heavily influenced by Joyce. There's no question about that.
So, this idea of reality testing, for as much as we want to ascribe the gene, which is appropriate, but it's on the question of confidence and this notion that Crowley and the turn of the century occultists and mystics talked about of the secret chiefs, right?
Yes.
I choose to believe that Kubrick, still being human, like you and I,
it doesn't matter really, though, as we already agreed,
harbored some question mark in his head or in his soul or wherever it may be of, is there anybody out there who I don't know, who I can't see, who remains shrouded, but when I release my movie and my vision, they will come to me. They will say, you have done well. Some approval from a father that is not there. And
very interesting theory.
And I think that
it's seductive, and it's an intelligent theory. But in a sense, what happens, and here's what I would say, I think you could be exactly right. Because this is what happens to Cain when he's cast out of Eden, right?
Okay.
He becomes a man without a father.
Okay.
So what he does is he establishes a tradition, a technical tradition. I mean, this is the thing that's missed a lot about Cain. Cain is the father of Enoch, who invented the Enochian systems, basically. Those Enochian systems, which are incredibly complex in their detail, out of which grow other things like the so-called kosher laws and the other mitzvah. Those are all minimal next to what is not spoken of in the book of Genesis, but only hinted at in the character of Enoch. Right? You learn more about Enoch and you realize that he was this man of supposed great magical power, the son of Cain. So you have this idea then of a system being built by a man cast out away from his father, who ends up becoming the father himself. He becomes, and you know, for listeners who follow the Always Record show or who are on the Sync Book Press, you know, Jason Barrera talks about this a lot, about how a person goes through a process where they themselves, through some aspect, it's like climbing the holy mountain to realize there's nothing there at the top but yourself. You know, it's lonely at the top. So it is an enticing theory, but...
Well, it's just, for as much vision as Stanley had and is so clearly illustrated in a movie so ahead of its time, his blind spots still remain as large and as expansive as anyone's. When it comes to...
Well, that's very interesting, you know, because you know what the original name for 2001 was, right?
Journey to the Stars or...
No, A Spot on the Sun.
Really?
I kid you not.
No shit.
So, if we're talking about a man who's trying to tell us that he's aware of something but that he doesn't quite know what it is, he sure has a hell of a way of identifying himself with it.
That's
the
good.
Subtlety of it is beyond anything that I... Like, you know, I'm a student of music, okay? Before my great fall, I was a professional musician. And, of course, the reason I had a great fall, it's not a job you can go back to because you're a contractor, basically. You know, you have contracts, and when you're suddenly no longer available for a period of time while you're trying to sort out why you literally went insane overnight, your career is over. You'd have to rebuild it from scratch, and that's not in any way a delightful prospect. So yeah, my life came to an end in that sense, and many others. But my study of music, you know, I mean, the intricacy of Bach, even, and I may seem to be gushing, seems almost laughably simple next to Kubrick's, the complexity of which he seemed to, I mean, you know, since we started this with a discussion about conspiracy theory and, you know, continuing along with the thread, there's so much in Kubrick's films that is incredibly detailed that appears to be, and of course that's all I can say, about 9/11 and also about the moon landings and whatnot. And they all presages. They all happen well before the event, and they're critically pointed in their detail. The more you look into them, the more depth, the more fluidity. And is this insanity on my behalf? I mean, have I lost my mind in thinking that Stanley Kubrick definitely was... He could have just been smart enough to have figured it out. Because this is the thing. They use this, you know, keyword hijacks and stuff like that. Stuff like this is put into popular culture. You know, you've ever read Kurt Vonnegut's work called Mother Night, or seen the movie Mother Night?
I saw the movie.
Okay, directed by Keith Gordon, yeah. Yeah, Mother Night, basically it's about this guy. He's an American spy, but right when the war begins, he's a radio announcer of some fame. And the Americans entice him to stay and to pander to the Nazis so that they can use his radio broadcast to give away critical messages to spies and insurgents inside Germany. And he agrees to do this, basically, to give coded messages. He doesn't even know what the codes themselves mean, right? So he's become lost now inside a world of code, essentially, right? Now, I can't remember exactly why I brought up Mother Night. Is it that sort of thing? Did Kubrick somehow figure out? Did he read? Was he smart enough to hear these broadcasts, which are commonplace to all of us, and to notice? Was he intelligent enough to notice and to draw from all of that deluge? And we know he was a massive reader, right? Newspapers, everything about local history, everything about world history, modern history, everything. Did he break a code and somehow realize? And this is... It's the only alternative to my other belief that he is exactly attached to the intelligence of Saturn itself some way, is that he broke a code somehow. He broke the Saturnian, what I believe to be the Saturnian code, and somehow represented it. My problem with that second theory, which appears to be the more sane of the two, is that it's such a hard code to read for us to understand what he's saying. It's so difficult that it appears to be almost, he's forcing us to break the Saturnian code. He's not revealing it to us. He's saying, here it is, break it. Here it is, I'll show you again. Here it is, break the code. Break the code. So he's inviting us down a certain path. And to me, that it's a fantastically dangerous, one might say it is a radiant abyss where one faces oneself eventually. In terms of Kubrick, and at the very beginning of our conspiracy discussion, I was going to say, after I had my Christian sort of, when I babysat for those people and read those books, right after that I saw 2001. And that was the thing that it completely galvanized my life in ways that are horrible beyond comprehension. There were things happening in the room that were sinks that I didn't know were sinks, right? And it was, now when I think about it, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. It's because I remember them. There was some guy. Do you mind if I tell you a little story here?
No, the floor is yours. Go for it.
There was some. I saw this movie completely, like you might say, dry. Some people who were very marginal acquaintances of mine in school said they were going to a midnight show. It was my birthday. I was already going to be hanging out with my friends downtown, And when they all went home, I decided I would go to this film with them, basically. I had no way to get home afterwards, and it was in the dead of winter, on my 15th birthday in 1981. And it was a midnight show, sold out, huge screen. And of course, this includes the famous overture with the completely black screen at the beginning for a good 5 minutes with music and the whole thing. Well, right around the time that Poole is making his fatal error, somebody started barking like a dog. And they went, arr, 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 arr. And they kept doing this for a good 15 or 20 seconds nonstop. And then someone said, well, somebody put a muzzle on that guy. And of course, he's saying Mazel, like Mazel Tov. M-Z-L. It's Oz. It means the same thing. Somebody, those two words, Mazel and Oz, they come to the same gematria, 77.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
Okay? So it doesn't only mean put a blessing on someone. It means put a blessing on someone. He's saying put a blessing on that guy. Somebody put a blessing on that guy. And related directly to the concept of Oz and the Wizard of Oz right in there. And anybody who studied Kubrick knows that he includes countless references to the Wizard of Oz in his movies, a film which he claimed to hate on purpose, basically, because he didn't want people to see how constantly he referenced it so easily. He wanted them to be adore him and take him at his word instead. So the depth of his subterfuge, the depth of it is so astonishing, it's so glimmering that to me, at this point, I'm going to stick to my original thesis, even though I am seduced. And I do appreciate your reality check, and it's a good reality check, quite frankly, in regards to Kubrick. Yes, he might have just broken some code. That is the only other possibility to me, is that he broke a code. But wow, the depth of it and the extraordinary sinks that have happened to me in regards to 2001 since that time, which relate directly to my so-called awakening, cannot be overlooked.
So I'm trying to think of another voice in this conversation that we always go back to, which of course is Philip K. Dick. Who maybe in terms of this way of thinking, Kubrick cracked the code, but Philip K. Dick saw the code, and was his work represents the effort to go ahead and try to crack it and get to the point where Stanley was.
Well, you know, now there's an important delineation here, because the idea of cracking as opposed to getting to it, you know, when one is cracking a code, one is working in a sense, but getting to it can happen by accident, essentially. And that's what happened to me. I'm not going to sit here in front of you or anybody else and say that my work is the result of a fact that I simply through my own ingenium came up with this. The fact is, something happened to me. So in that sense, I am in the exact same category as Dick. Something happened to me, and just like Dick, it shattered my world, essentially, and it completely changed the direction of everything I was doing at that point.
Well, with Philip K. Dick, the experience that everyone goes back to is in 74.
That's right.
Now,
we can go into that. Wow. That's a very critical year. But, 7/4.
But
go
his
ahead.
the output of his work extending back into the 50s all seem like a precursor to that experience.
Yes, but that fits into our it's true. But it fits into our concept of our own Gnostic awakenings. That is to say that everything we did in the past suddenly had a tinge to it that was informed by a present event.
So
and that's what I think happened to Dick. He was on to something, sure. I was on to something too. I spent 25 years of my life, day in and day out, trying to understand 2001. Everything, that's not an exaggeration, because it became a context for my reality, basically. Trying to understand this impossible mystery became a context for a philosophical outlook on reality. So even when I was having conversations with people about things that might have seemed trivial, in some way I was influenced by that, although I didn't realize it at the time.
Okay, so
in the
concept of obsession, which is the word that people...
I would say compulsion on my opinion.
Compulsion and obsession is how people label people's involvement with works like 2001, right?
Yes.
But yet, if it's the Bible, it's a sort of devotion, or it's a certain... like there's a different realm for people who have... who read the Bible every day, who have read
it... that's because the Bible has had time to be sweetened. You know, when you start stirring things around in the pot, everything is bitter. And of course, the beginning of Genesis is the conquest of bitterness. That's why they eat the bitter herb at Passover, to remind them of the bitter struggle that they went through. But by the end of it, it's all supposedly sweetened, essentially. And then it's handed to people as a sweetened prospect. And over time, that's what it becomes. And they find some kind of glory in it, essentially. And of course, we're talking about the change of an age, right? I mean, the Piscean Age, the age represented, very frankly, by the appearance of Christ in the so-called time continuum, or what people would call history, essentially, is exactly the age of Pisces. And now we have the age of Aquarius, which I believe essentially began with a real bang on September 11th, 2001, essentially. That was the millennium bug that everybody was worried about. Because, of course, the millennium isn't in the year 2000. It's 2001, because the first year was one and not zero. So that's it. That was the moment when the forces of the Aquarian world were unleashed on the world. And so now, people who talk about Kubrick the way we do, we're religious fanatics to them. That's what we are, essentially.
Yes, yes.
And especially when I say, when we talk about it the way we do, lots of people talk about Kubrick and what a great filmmaker he was, and they put up their fan sites to him and how much they love him. And other people tremulously attempt, and I would put, you know, Rob Adger would be at the apex of this category of people who are essentially fans who want to praise the genius of this man without examining what does it mean, right? Sure, he seemed to show us this and this and this, and he's telling you, but why? What?
It's the self-reflection. It's the drawing of your own self into the mix.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. For me, that happened instantly when I saw 2001. I was drawn into that mix, and that was that, basically.
This is my experience.
And that was the year that I had my so-called awakening, too. It happened in the summer of 2001, and my whole life went from literally... Some people wrote to me and said, you know, it was a train wreck. That's what happened to you, was a train wreck, essentially. They called it, I completely derailed. That was how people felt about me. I don't have a single friend from that period. My whole life, they're all gone. No, none of them exist anymore. And when I talk, they think I'm crazy. And that's how they see me, as a crazy person, basically. That's how profoundly wild and extremely personal what happened to me was. And that's why I relate so strongly to Dick, just to bring it back to Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
Because when he had his experience, it was something that nearly caused his death, and it was very closely related to a physical ailment that nearly killed him, basically. And that's how it went for me too. So he had a toothache. I don't know, and he had a terrible fever. He was literally on the verge of death. Are you aware of this about Dick?
I backwards and forwards, man. Backwards and forwards.
Yeah, he had a terrible toothache.
And sodium pentothal, the girl at the door.
Yeah, that's right.
The fish necklace, and it just...
That's right, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So
it was a breakdown, basically. And that's what it is. It's a breakdown of reality. And isn't that what we do? Isn't that what explorers of the so-called sync phenomenon do? We break things down into their component parts. So that's what's happening to us. It is a breakdown, basically. Obviously, it's a part of a process, and I'm not a Buddhist in the sense that I hold out hope, basically, for an actual permanent, potentially permanent, but at least satisfying some kind of resolution to all of this. I'm not sure what that's going to be, and I wouldn't dare speculate on it.
Terence McKenna, to go back to one of his central concepts, and I believe he held on to this very deeply, even towards the end, was that salvation is an act of all-encompassing comprehension. That it is to not experience life, but to comprehend it. To have a deep, self-reflective, felt understanding of the immediate now. And it is in that act that you achieve your salvation, which, it to me, most of my psychedelic education began, or the first voice that said, okay, what I'm experiencing is not, you know, a Grateful Dead show. The thoughts that I'm feeling are not, hey, let's go swimming and let's go run around in the forest. I mean, I was at the University of Illinois, and I went to the library to find a book by some Harvard guys, And I had to sign a piece of paper, a request form to get this book. And it had to be taken out specially, and I had to sign over. And I get this book by some Harvard psychologists. And in their manual of what they try to describe what the psychedelic experience is all about is reflection upon the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And right there, I knew that I was on the right path, that what was happening to me and what I was thinking wasn't isolated, that it was...
Well, sure, because something was coming through the creative side of your mind that connected with a piece of knowledge on the logical side of your mind. Those two things remained separate at a certain point, and then they came together. And of course, depending upon who you're with and the type of people you surround yourself with, that can be a very positive or negative experience. So,
Absolutely. So this idea that even these, I just think it's fascinating that Leary was over the age of 40 when he first merged these two sides of his mind, when he broke open his head, because
I was 35 myself. So,
the linear left side, if that's what our model is going to be, when the flash of lightning of his creative infinity merged with his linear left brain, that linear brain had built a structure that included his Irish heritage, his Catholic heritage, his educational understanding, his to be a father, to have children. That flash of lightning was able to filter through an incredibly complicated and detailed structure. So a lot more light, if this is the model, flashed in his brain, and he saw it. And when he looked for something in his educational background to connect it to, it's no wonder that he reached for the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it's a book that seemingly I rarely hear mentioned in this work anymore.
Unless you could go to Crowley.
Okay.
And you know, considering the Beatles and the psychedelic connection there, it's a good place to start. You know, Crowley's controversial, obviously, but he does talk about all this stuff.
Absolutely. And I fell into the spell and the mystery that is Crowley. And I think what you and I would agree with is that, you know, spend your time with Crowley. That's great. Join a lodge. More power to you. But have you checked out Stanley Kubrick? Because there is a graduation there. I think
there is a graduate. There absolutely. I mean, and you know, Crowley knew this, and he was bitter about it too.
Yeah,
he was the beast. There is no question he unleashed this into the modern world, in my opinion. However, I mean, all I mean that is in the sense of as a portal, basically.
Well, he is the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Led Zeppelin all rolled into one ball of energy.
And Pink Floyd.
And.
You'll see.
But I think that Pink Floyd...
Just go back to the... Have you read the entire Floyd Kubrick site?
Yes.
The entire site? Some guy back in the, you know, what? How many hits has that site had now? 400? You know? It's been out there for... And it's
see, I've been waiting for you to tell me that you created that website all this time.
I did not.
And I wonder who did. It's just such a beautiful anomaly.
I'll tell you what, at the time it was created, I was reading into the Publius Enigma, basically.
Okay.
Although I had not listened to any Floyd. I was just interested in puzzles and sort of things like that.
Yes.
But I had no idea that he wrote about it as well, the Publius Enigma,
yeah.
The big mystery puzzle. So that was there too. But
I'm just saying, before you continue...
I could be wrong about Floyd.
I'm just saying the energy, the brashness,
the
rebel, the angry teenager. Yeah. He approached the spiritual higher-ups and the sanctimonious crap with the sneer of Jagger and the feedback of Jimmy Page and just, you know...
And the Beatles. The Beatles are a very important connection.
But tempered with... Hey, you think I'm a monster and I'm a freak and I'm doing. I still want to come home to someone who loves me. I still want.
Right. I would put Floyd out of that category.
Okay.
You're right. They do belong in a different group. So.
Yeah. So
Point clause.
So, with Crowley and the Book of the Dead, I think that it people get stuck on Crowley, and I'll be honest, I was stuck on Crowley for, Christ, man, 12, 10 years, a decade easy, of just reading, rereading, going back, re-identifying, rethinking, and...
well, I mean, you could certainly consider the man a success.
Yes, absolutely. I recently compared him to psychic chemotherapy for the Irish Catholic soul.
Beautiful.
He's a medicine.
I like Crowley for the same reason, because of the natural Catholicism almost about what he's saying.
He comes from that background. And he's trying to remove a tumor that is in the way, that has outgrown its need, and it needs to be dissolved. Mm-hmm. And you, if you've been conditioned and programmed in that school, you do that in the face of eternal damnation. And mm-hmm. he's saying, however you need to get out of that.
Yeah, for me, it was definitely that too.
In a sense, it
still is. Yeah.
And it's. I think you might. And yeah, I think you've said as much. It still haunts me today on some level of
I think that as long as the condition, and this relates to the whole gestalt of the situation of the world, the true reality of the world we're living in is that there is a great deal of pain and suffering. And it's consciousness itself that this suffering comes from. So we are, because obviously, you know, animals, you know, they rut with each other, they reproduce, they forage for food, they rot, and they die. It's what happens to them, right? So that's just the way it is. Consciousness puts an end to all that. It appears to say, you know what, you're not getting out the easy way. You're not an animal after all. And, you know, you're basically screwed. And it is, but it's a beautiful screw, you know. and that's why I feel... For me, to be real about it, I have to stay ambivalent. I have to stay completely ambivalent about what's happening. I cannot just say, you know, this is something that needed to happen, that was a good thing, but I cannot condemn the process either. Because it's clear that as long as it's a process, the end result remains a question. There is still ink in the pen of reality, basically. And that's the way it is. And I consider that to be what I would call... aptly a catch-22, you know, it's the way it is. This is the Buddhistic side of me, particularly the Zen Buddhist side of me, which is to say Zen Buddhism, Buddhist Muda, you know, who cares, enlightenment, forget about it, basically. Go be a dishwasher. go clean your kitchen. That's it. That's all there is to it. You know, if it's out there, if it's small and you can do it, then just, you know, polish your bowl, basically, and stop messing with the primordial force of nature. But on the other hand, the seduced side of me, the Catholic side of me, the one that's been soaked in the evil blood of history, kind of revels in it. It's fantastically gorgeous, you know. It is a mystery play, and it goes on right now, and it's still going on. It remains unresolved. Right now, we are definitely, you know, in the state of reality that I would call art, basically.
Okay.
If we're anywhere in the Tarot deck, it's sometimes called temperance, right? You know, in the Tarot progression, something is happening. There's a coagulation taking place, but there's also a dissipation.
Okay, so to focus in on the Tarot, which is as necessary as the phonetic alphabet in today's world, that if you're going to approach these higher levels of what we seem to call awareness or conscious awareness, you're gonna need a tool for literacy. And the tarot is as good an alphabet as has ever been devised.
It's pretty good. There's one slightly better, which is the Hebrew alphabet.
Well, okay, so I agree with you. And
the two studies are directly related to each other.
Now, I would say that to focus in on what sync is, my definition has come to be that when someone speaks to you in the same language using the same alphabet, that is a synchronicity that is just accepted for being, it's not...
It's codified is what it is.
Okay.
It's or macerated might be the better word for word lovers. Basically, it's been, it's solid, basically. Everybody agrees.
Everyone agrees.
On what that word letter means. They might not know what it means, but they all agree.
Like, why does somebody, when they drop a dish, say shit? It syncs up with the word that I choose when I drop a dish. It has no meaning, but we have attached the same four letters to the feeling.
Well, but it does have a meaning. It does have a meaning, though. You see, it actually does. That's the whole point. The letters themselves, which have become macerated, do have a meaning. So the maceration or the coagulation of that, what happens in that is that everyone agrees that they understand. There's no fighting about what the letter A means or the letter B. There are, and the people who are fighting about it have agreed to fight about it. They've made an agreement, essentially, to go in and discuss this. And that becomes Talmudic study, basically. It becomes Kabbalah.
Okay.
Once you're doing that. And, you know, people might say, well, Kabbalah this, Kabbalah that. And Kabbalists ignore those people. They literally couldn't care less what those people think. A real Kabbalist, not popular Kabbalist. There's a difference because... you know, it's the study, right? That's all it can ever be to a real Kabbalist. Real, according to the, because this is the thing. If you know, you got to go, and this is a point that I thought that we might get to in regards to sync philosophy. When trying to appreciate a meaning, you need to go back to the beginning. It's just like reading a book. You know, you need to start a book at the beginning. And this is one of the things about sync that I feel has a slightly sinister twist to it, is that you enter into it. It's like a gyroscope, you know, and you can't really know what the beginning is. So looking into the beginnings of things is one of the most important aspects, I think, for understand. And it all ultimately become, you know, let me put it to you this way. Do you realize that the overwhelming majority, I wouldn't dare speculate, but I'd say up to 90% of all Jewish study of the Hebrew text. Remember, Kabbalah begins with the study of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. That's where that is the basis for Kabbalah. So right there, that's the beginning. So if you're interested in Kabbalah and Tarot, the word Tarot derives from Torah, basically, you might consider going back to the beginning, looking at these things. And you might be interested to know that the overwhelming majority of the study of the Hebrew texts is just the first sentence of Genesis. The overwhelming majority, certainly a bell curve majority, certainly two-thirds of the work is just attempting to understand. Do you know that among Jews, I'm talking about mystical Jews or Kabbalists, there's no agreement as to what this means.
Wow.
No agreement. It has to do with something coming out of the head, something leaping out of the head, basically. And we're right back to breaking open the head, essentially.
Yeah. I think that... For some reason, and this goes back to my Catholic programming and upbringing, is that it took me a long time to see the word Hebrew or Jew and be able to transcend that label on the thinking.
That's because the illusion of
that there is Hebrew thinking and that there is Hebrew wisdom. And as a Catholic, you don't let that enter into your head because that is something outside of the dominion. We are put you in this church. We give you Catholic thinking because that's all you need to focus on. Anything that you dabble with out there will lead to Satan or to a fall or to excommunication. So to be able to appreciate what Torah is, what the Hebrew alphabet is, to realize it as what it truly is human comprehension. Human, it's a human thing. It is in all of our blood. It is in all of our minds. It is to be shared by everybody. It's a glorious and majestic and magical creation. And I think
there is no question about that.
I think
it's a pity that the so-called intellectual and the big pity is the logical world, right?
Yes.
I mean, all these people, will love to talk about, say, Stephen Hawking and his intelligence, and that, you know, he holds the, I think it's the occlusion or ecclesian chair at Oxford, or no, Cambridge, the chair of mathematics that was held by Isaac Newton. And of course, Isaac Newton was a rampant capitalist, basically a rampant alchemist. And you know, if you were speaking today, that's what he'd be telling people to look into. You know, but and this is why this new science and the new atheism is a very important, and I believe generated, false trail, essentially, because there's lots of smart people out there. There's plenty of intelligent people out there, people with good minds who know how to think. But it's not that hard to put a giant domino right in front of them. You can just stick it there into the ground, and that's all they do is look at it and go, oh, it's empty. There's nothing there. There's nothing there. How can there be nothing? There used to be the other side of my cave, and now there's nothing. You know?
Yeah.
There it is. It's nothing. Yeah.
It's too simple.
And that's another thing that Kubrick played to. Kubrick played right into this. To the love and the belief in new science that he knew was coming, which is being established as a kind of a new religion, basically. A new sort of false religion, the new science, in my opinion.
Okay. So.
I can elaborate on that if you want, but we can move on too.
Keep going.
Well, here's the thing, okay, and this is a... I talked a little while ago about going to the beginning, okay?
Okay.
The first lecture in the Book of the Golden Dawn, I almost feel that you don't ever have to go past it, quite frankly, in my opinion. I have not. People have talked to me about whether or not I love words because I'm a writer, friends and stuff like that, and I've been accused of loving words. And I say, I don't really love words. I'm sort of crazy about letters. And I'm still trying to figure out what the letter A means, basically, you know, exactly what it means. And, you know, some people find that to be a bit flippant, anyway, so, how did this, oh yeah, so what I think, the concept of going to the beginning, back to the beginning, here's the thing, and this relates directly to this concept of the new science and the idea that there is no creative principle behind the universe. You can strike the word creative right out of it. Forget about it. Just call it a principle. Right? It's still a first cause. It's still some kind of action, and it has to have some sort of purpose behind it to hold together. And this is, again, what Dick was trying to hit at. How do you create a universe that doesn't fall apart in 2 days?
Okay.
Well, forget about it. How do you create a universe that doesn't fall apart instantly? How do you create a universe that doesn't instantly dissolve? And this is what is the thing that is being missed by so many people, is that the miraculous is everything. That's what's miraculous about reality. And this is the sub-banner to my blog. Nothing is impossible, and so is everything else. What's taking place right now is impossible. It can't possibly be happening. And if you think about the beginning of things, you'll see this. I believe that meditation, because this is my main tool, and it has been for a long time. I didn't use any kind of drugs or mind-expanding things until I was well into my 30s, basically. And that was what cracked my little noodle quite widely open, and it was a rude awakening. But anyway, just thinking about things, I've been a person, because of the fact that I've been a musician, you know, I don't work a lot, basically. I'm not a music teacher. I was a performer, that's it. I showed up and played, and then I went home, and I lived on that. So I worked, you know, 4 to 6 hours a week, basically. And I'm a loner, so that meant I could pretty much do whatever I wanted to for incredibly long periods of time, just sit and think. Well, another great thinker who talks about this that we're both a fan of, and listeners probably will be, is Robert Anton Wilson. He talks about the concept of just sitting there, and this is an exercise that everyone should do. And I use that word should possibly in the wrong way. I think people will really enjoy this process. Let's just put it that way. That's more E prime, more maybe logic, since we're talking about Wilson. But anyway, what you do is you just start thinking about how you got where you are, and in a very specific sense. Like, how did I get into this chair? basically. And you go backwards from there. And you keep going backwards, and you keep going backwards, and you don't stop until you can tell everything about how you got into this chair. And inevitably, you will end up at the concept of a first cause. This is the awakening, and it is possible through meditation. This is what the Buddhists do, and it's what they recommend, right? Zen Buddhist is the meditative process to achieve it. But entheogens, psychedelic drugs, do speed up the process. I'm not sure if it's a right or wrong thing. I'm not even going to comment on that per se, because I've done it, so I'm down that path, right? But I don't think there's any difference, basically, between the ultimate revelation, which is that of the concept of some kind of first cause. And you could say, to use an example of this, William Blake might be an example of, and we know he used entheogens, right? He romping around talking about fairies in the forest. Yeah, okay, all right. The guy is chowing down on the shroom. That's all there is to it. We know it. And he was smart enough to put it together too, right? He was smart enough to realize that the Christian myth is an allegory for entheogens, right? Yes. Which it is. Yes. Christ being the red-headed mushroom, essentially, mm-hmm. that we all partake of in order to achieve, this has been written about, John Lennon based a lot of his songs on that discovery, so-called discovery in the 1960s. But the fact is, Blake probably figured that out on his own and decided to go out and give these things a try. Well, what does Blake draw? He draws the creator with a compass, basically. And this is the concept of hierarchy in and of itself. That's all it is to it. I mean, when you are thinking of how you get into this chair, how you get to where you are, if you really want to know, you've got to follow the hierarchy. You've just got to keep going, pushing your mind one further step up the pyramid, as far as it can go, basically, until you finally get to the top. And that's your Gnostic experience right there. That's when the skull breaks open and you realize, hey, wait a second, I might very well be at the center of the universe. And if I'm not, somebody else definitely is.
Well, in that practice of how did I get here, when you combine that with an entheogenic or psychedelic accelerator, mm-hmm. what is the role of educational background in that moment?
That's a very good question. You know,
educational background provide rungs of a ladder with which to progress deeper into the subtleties of that practice. So as...
No, I'll tell you.
Okay.
No, continue. Finish your
thought. I think of this. Okay, just remove the body from it and allow the brain to just be a brain. If you're going to put this accelerator into the brain, and you have two brains, one brain born, grows up, rurally, nomadically, and is 15 years old and has lived out nomadically in the countryside or wherever that may be. You don't even have to label it a year. It could be 3,000 years ago. It could be 500 right. years ago. It could be 20 years from now. That brain has its surrounding reality. It has its family lineage, but it pretty much knows it's just its nomadic life.
Right.
You have another brain that has read newspapers, seen day-to-day news updates, has read history books, has learned how to read music and play a musical instrument, has learned how to play sports and played in as part of teams, has learned the hierarchy of that, has learned mathematics, has mm-hmm. not only learned addition, subtraction, division, multiplication, but has understood algebra, has understood geometry.
About many different layers here.
All
many,
these
many
different layers. Potential layers. So these programs exist in this brain.
Yes.
So this is in that linear left-hand side. When you put this accelerator into it, when the certain chemicals follow through the blood into the brain and that bridge and that eclipse of that unconscious that knows of its immortality and that linear brain which knows of its mortality, when you fuse these two things, you have the one brain, nomadic, you have the other brain exposed to all those things. I contend that what the brain is able to accomplish is radically different.
I'm going to challenge you on this.
Okay, I appreciate that.
What I think you're talking about is very important here. And this may seem a little off topic, but I'm gonna go to a more general principle just to start us off here, because the actual principle that you're talking about is maybe a bit shocking.
Okay.
So start with just the general principle of learning and experience in life. Okay. When I was very young, like most young men, go ahead.
We're going to take one quick break.
Okay, sure.
And we'll start off with this topic for the part three, okay?
Sounds great.
All right.
See you in a minute.